Good morning. I'm Sharon Leon from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, and I'd like to welcome you to the March 9th Object of History audiocast. The Object of History is a joint project of the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History that provides students and teachers around the country with a look at objects from NMAH's collections. Our focus today is the Woolworth's lunch counter from Greensboro, North Carolina, where four young African-American college students sat down on February 1, 1960, and refused to leave until they were served. That sit-in eventually prompted the desegregation of the Woolworth's lunch counter in July 1960, but it also launched a movement of nonviolent direct action protest against segregation across the South. We're joined today by three guests who will answer your questions about the lunch counter, the Woolworth's sit-in, and its impact on the civil rights movement. First, at the National Museum of American History is Bill Yangst, chair of the Division of Home and Community Life. His primary responsibility for researching and collecting in the area of American social history, household and family life, and domestic furnishings. Bill works with collections that range from entire houses to furniture to Tupperware to toasters to toys. To firefighting objects. Yangst is the curator who actually collected the Woolworth's lunch counter, and over the last 25 years he has curated several exhibitions at the Smithsonian and written a number of articles about collecting the lunch counter and issues of collecting material from the recent past. Second, Faith Davis Ruffins is curator of African American history and culture for the Division of Home and Community Life. She has worked as a historian and a curator at NMAH since 1981. And from 1988 to 2000, she was the head of the collection of advertising history at the Archive Center. Davis Ruffins is widely published on issues relating to African American history, museums, historic preservation, and public history. She's worked on a number of exhibits at NMAH, including curating Ralph J. Bunch, Statesman, Activist, and Peacemaker. And she has been a guest curator for the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, the Ghana Smithsonian Exhibition Project, in the National Afro-American Museum of Cultural Center. And third, historian Stephen Lawson is joining us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, where he's professor of American history at Rutgers State University of New Jersey. Professor Lawson is an expert on African-American politics, particularly with regard to voting rights. Since 1972, after receiving his PhD in history from Columbia University, he's taught and served as department head at the University of South Florida, Tampa, the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He has been at Rutgers since 1998. Professor Lawson has written numerous books, including Black Ballots, Voting Rights in the South, 1944 to 1969, Running for Freedom, Civil Rights and Black Politics in America since 1941, and Civil Rights Crossroads, Nation, Community, and the Black Freedom Struggle. We're accepting questions today from students and teachers around the country. If you'd like to submit a question for our guests, you can do so either through the website, which is objectivehistory.org, by going to the forum page and filling out the question form, or by email to teachers@objectivehistory.org. So we're going to begin today with a question from Needham, Massachusetts, that I think probably is a good question for Bill since he collected the lunch counter. This question is from a student, a junior in Needham, who wants to know sort of what's considered important when you're preserving an object like the lunch counter? Why did you only pick a section, and how did you make that decision?
Okay. In my role as curator, what I do is help the National Museum of American History collect and preserve objects to create a lasting material record of American history. Back in 1993, I was helping the museum document the role young people play in bringing about social, cultural, and political change in American life. And when I learned that the Greensboro Woolworth store was closing, it struck this chord with me that this very important event occurred there on February 1st, 1960, where four African American students walked in, sat at a lunch counter, and asked to be treated as equals. And so I decided to pursue the acquisition of a portion of that counter for the museum. And when we look at objects, these things play different roles in American life, and that was certainly true for the lunch counter. They have multiple meanings. So it's like peeling back the layers of an onion, if you will, to sort of uncover these different meanings. Because ultimately what we're trying to do is reconnect these things, these objects, with people and history so that we can tell stories. Now, let's see. So the reason we took a small portion of the counter. It actually was a counter that extended the full length of the store and across the back of the store. It seated 69 individuals. And what we wanted was something that simply could represent that history here at the museum. A colleague and I flew down to Greensboro and met with members of the local city council and other folks and agreed that what we would like to have is four stools, a corresponding 8-foot section of the counter, the soda fountain behind the counter, a section of the cornice, and so on. And there was a group of citizens who had formed an organization called Sit-In Movement, Inc. in the community to preserve the site. And so we wanted to work with them to ensure that this very important story could be told at the local level, the regional level, and the national level.
Very good. Faith, as curator of African American history and culture, is there an ongoing museum-wide agenda about collecting material from the civil rights movement?
The museum is in the process now of developing a museum-wide collecting plan for African American materials that includes but is not limited to the civil rights movement. There is one particular division, the Division of Politics and Reform, that currently has the bulk of the museum's civil rights collection, and they are actively out searching for additional civil rights materials, yes.
Very good. All right, we've got a lot of questions today about the sit-ins themselves, and the first one comes from Charleston, South Carolina, and it seems to be prompted by one of the photos on the site of white ministers picketing outside the Woolworths store. And the question is, if some of the participants were white, did they picket outside or did they sit at the counters? One picture of the lunch counter website shows a white man being hassled by another white man standing behind him. Did these white participants indicate that they were sitting in support of the sit-in since they could be served? That's an interesting question, too. There is a picture from later in the sit-in movements of a white person sitting with a bunch of African-American students in protest. And how did they differentiate themselves from the African-American as being people protesting segregation? Stephen, maybe you could speak to that?
Yeah, obviously the initial sit-ins, and this includes Greensboro in 1960, were black people, but there were sympathetic whites in the community, particularly associated with some of the local colleges. The main college that sent white people actually sent white women. That was North Carolina College for Women, which later became UNC Greensboro. Women actually played a very important role in the sit-ins. It's kind of ironic that the pictures that everyone the four black men, and of course they deserve all the credit in the world, but Bennett College, which was a black women's college in Greensboro, supplied a large number of women. The North Carolina College for Women supplied some women, and North Carolina A&T, which also had women, supplied it. It's hard to say what percentage of the total sit-iners were women, but it's a pretty large large percentage. How did they distinguish the supporters from just ordinary white people? Well, it wasn't that difficult to do it, because what the white people would do would be sitting next to black people. The other people who were not associated with the sit-ins wouldn't sit next to the black folk. They either left the counters altogether, which is pretty much the case. Once blacks came into the counters, the whites who were there and didn't want to sit, you know, with black people left. And there were not so much in Greensboro. Greensboro didn't really encounter very much violence from whites, but in places like Nashville and in the deeper South in later years, particularly in Mississippi and Alabama, there was a good deal of white young adults and adults coming in and actually getting in the faces of the sit-in people, white and, as well as black. The white people, in many ways, the white supporters shared a particular hatred from the white opponents, because they were looked upon as traitors to their race. They were looked upon, you know, as people who had abandoned white supremacy. So they got a particularly bad beating from some of these white folks.
All right. As I said, we have a number of questions about the sit-ins themselves. The next one is from Toledo, Ohio, and the student wants to know whether the entire sit-in at Greensboro consisted of were the four students who began the sit-ins the first day consistently there, and did participants take shifts? Did they sit from open to close? I mean, was there sort of a logistical planning scheme for the way these things happened? Maybe you could address that, Faith.
That's a really good question. I was going to say you should ask Stephen that specifically.
Okay.
Specifically for Greensboro.
For Greensboro.
What I would say in general is that you have to look at these different sit-ins, and some were very well planned, some were more spontaneous in nature. And let Stephen talk about Greensboro specifically.
Yeah, I mean, Greensboro wasn't as planned out in a way that the question would suggest. It really, the four young men did think about this for a while. They thought about it really, they were freshmen. They had just come to college in the previous fall, and they had a number of late night sessions in which they talked about, you know, race in general and the discrimination that was taking place. They also had discussions with people in the local community. They were two of the four men were members of the NAACP youth councils, which were very active in supporting sit-ins both before 1960 and after 1960. But they hadn't really formulated a well thought out plan, like we're going to go at a particular time, we're going to sit in for this many hours, we're going to mobilize other people. That hadn't really taken place until after they sat in. Once word got around, other students from the various colleges and even the high school, the local high school, Dudley High School, joined in. No one sat in all day, day after day. People just came, and if they could get the seats, they would take it. Others picketed outside the store, as you said, as well. So there was room for quite a lot of people. And after about a week or so, the local authorities decided that they didn't want the bad publicity from all of this, and the mayor appointed a citizens committee to try to work out a solution. And it took about 5 months, and they ultimately did work out a solution where the Woolworths, the Cresses, a couple of other places would be desegregated. But if it were not for the local college students themselves, and they would not have been able to sustain the sit-in in the first week or so.
Very good. We have a related question here from Birmingham, Alabama, about the role of the press. And the student wants to know whether the event received a lot of press, and if so, was it viewed favorably in the media or not? And I suppose probably that's a question that depends on where you're sitting watching the TV or listening to the radio. Faith, is there a lot of information in the museum about press and coverage of these sorts of things?
One thing I would just sort of comment is that there isn't sort of the media. There is no unified media response. In newspapers, let's just sort of start with newspapers, in, of course, many southern newspapers, this was seen as a tremendous outrage, and people wrote in letters, and there were editorials, and there were negative articles about, troublemakers who were causing difficulty. When you look at what might be considered northern-based major networks, there was reporting on television, but it's probably more significant, I would say, at this point, newspaper responses. And many newspapers in what might be called the North expressed surprise. There was a mixed sense. Some people felt this was great, other people did not. But if you look at African American newspapers, which were still quite important at that time, in the late 50s and in the early 60s, you see people expressing also a variety of opinions, but there is, there are probably more people writing in to express support than in some of the northern white newspapers, but there is a range of response, and some conservative black leaders felt that this was just going to be a problem, and other people felt that it was a rising tide of a rising tide that was going to help change America. I mean, you've already had several Supreme Court decisions and other activities. The Montgomery bus boycott had happened by the time this started. So there are people who are seeing it as part of a great awakening, one might say. At the same time, and this wasn't necessarily just in newspapers, but there are also people who are concerned that this spontaneity doesn't really have effective leadership. People who might be ministers, black ministers, and that sort of thing. So when you say the media, radio and television are very important, but I would still probably argue that newspapers had at least as much importance, and there's no unified response by the media, per se.
Very good. Well, and, this working out nicely. We're just sort of moving through the questions in a very related way. The next question I have is from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the question is whether or not Martin Luther King Jr. participated in any sit-ins. I mean, students tend to think about him when they think about the civil rights movement, he and Rosa Parks. And so the question is whether or not Martin Luther King played a major role in these events.
Well, I mean, not in Greensboro.
Right.
When Greensboro occurred, Martin Luther King was in the process of moving from Montgomery, Alabama to Atlanta, where he would then take over his, you know, father's church in Atlanta. And so he was not involved immediately, but as the sit-in spread from Greensboro to Durham, there were people in Durham who wanted to invite King, because King was by that point pretty well known, although he hadn't really done an awful lot more than the Montgomery bus boycott. And King went to Durham, and he gave a public lecture in Durham in which he came out supporting supporting the sit-ins, and in fact saying that this is not a black-white issue, this is an issue of injustice versus justice. So he tried to broaden it in ways that he usually did. What's interesting about the sit-ins, of course, and then the Freedom Rides, is that both of these would occur without the initiation or direct participation of Dr. King. I mean, that's what makes the 1960-63 civil rights struggle so important. It really comes out without Dr. King's, direct initiative. He was supportive of all that happened. That wasn't the issue. But in terms of implementing the tactics of nonviolent civil disobedience, for which he would be well known, it really comes from younger people, particularly those who, after the sit-ins, formed an organization called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and also another group that had been around a long time but had kind of gone into decline but was revived in 1960, and that's the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE. They became the two groups that really initiated much of this. But in 1960, after the Greensboro sit-ins and the sit-ins around the country, King was a pastor in Atlanta. And he had actually, with Atlanta, where he was, he had to be very careful, because there had been a long time established black leadership, leadership of ministers, of which his father, Martin Luther King Sr., was one of the important ones. And King sort of told his father that he really wouldn't become active in any of the local activities in Atlanta, that he did not want to cause his father any difficulties. But Atlanta was also the headquarters of SNCC, and during the presidential election of 1960, in October of 1960, SNCC in Atlanta, led by Julian Bond, who today is the chairman of the board of the NAACP, but back then was a SNCC organizer, they wanted to have a sit-in in a department store, which was then the most popular department store in Atlanta, named Rich's Department Store. And Rich's had a restaurant. It wasn't really a lunch counter. It was more of a regular restaurant, but the restaurant didn't take in black people. So SNCC convinced King to participate in this demonstration inside the department store in the restaurant, and King did, along with the young people in Atlanta, and he was then arrested. And that arrest became an important political issue in the 1960 presidential election, which people have argued, and I think there's some merit to it, that turned the election in favor of John F. Kennedy against Richard Nixon, because Kennedy actually came out in speaking out against King's arrest, and also through his brother Robert, who would later become his attorney general, was instrumental in getting King released from prison, whereas Richard Nixon didn't comment and didn't do anything about it. And as a result of that, African-American votes, which may have been on the border at that time, couldn't decide which way to go, swung toward Kennedy. And Kennedy won by less than 1% of the popular vote. And it's clear that without African-American votes, without Martin Luther King having been involved in this sit-in, and so forth, Kennedy wouldn't have won. So the one major sit-in that King was involved really helped turn the tide in the presidential election in 1960. But King didn't really participate very much in those kinds of demonstrations. over the next 3 or 4 years.
Interesting.
I think it's worth it to just mention that there were perceived generational differences between King and the students who were involved in SNCC and the somewhat younger, but not entirely younger, group of people who were involved in CORE. And the protest activities that came out from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, King's organization, and that emerged from black churches had different development, had a different process of development than the sit-ins and freedom rides, which really were organized by the young people and college students from SNCC and the mostly younger but very activist people from CORE. There are the civil rights movement seems, I think, for younger people to all be a very sculpted, almost ritualistic process. But in fact, it was very tumultuous and chaotic even, and lots of different people were doing different things, not all in agreement with each other. And that sense, it's useful to get a sense of that, that things are kind of happening all over and Martin Luther King isn't everywhere and isn't even everywhere liked.
Right. And just to add to that, today, when many people think about the civil rights movement, they remember mainly the actions of these well-known figures, like Dr. King and Rosa Parks and others. But while their influence and visions were really undeniable, it was really a mass movement that was sustained by ordinary people, and it was in the course of their daily lives who exhibited just incredible courage and sacrifice in these acts of defiance.
Bill, I have another question for you. Based on, you said when you went to collect the lunch counter, you had been working on an exhibit about young people. And did the lunch counter ever actually appear in that exhibit, or did the thinking about sort of a unified exhibit about youth appear in the Sitting for Justice exhibit?
Excuse me. Actually, in a general way, we talk about the role of young people, because these were in the Sitting for Justice exhibition. We pointed out that these were four 18-year-old college students who, their sitting was carefully planned, but it was also, in large part fueled by their own beliefs and principles and with their own frustrations of living in the segregated culture in Greensboro and elsewhere in America. But we've never had a broader exhibition that really looks at young people and their influence in shaping history and how they were shaped by history.
It would be a huge undertaking, I'm sure. So we actually have a lot of questions about the students themselves, and I think sort of one of them that relates to sort of a whole host of sit-ins and may move us to talk about Nashville and other places. I have a question from Aberdeen, South Dakota. And they wanted to know, this student wanted to know whether the four students who participated in the sit-ins continued to be leaders in other aspects of the civil rights movement. Maybe we could start with you on that, Stephen. I know that is true of leaders of other sit-ins, but what about these four
right.
in Greensboro?
They did continue. I think Franklin McCain talks about having gone to the founding conference of SNCC in Raleigh in 1960, and Hazel Blair as well were involved. But they did not become, they went to school, they graduated, but they did not become involved really in any of the organizations on an ongoing basis through the 1960s. They did not become the leaders of SNCC or CORE or any of that. This was, you know, their major contribution, although they continue to remain concerned. Franklin McCain, who was one of the four people in the sit-in, he gives a very good interview. There are many different interviews with these four people that exist out there, and they all capture them at a particular moment in their lives in which they can remember certain things. But there's a very good interview with Franklin McCain in a book by Howell Raines called My Soul Is Rested, which are oral history interviews of various people who are involved in one way or another in the civil rights movement. And McCain kind of sums up how he felt the particular day in which he was involved. And he says that he probably has never felt better in his entire life. He never felt more like a person, like a human being, in his entire life than when he went to that lunch counter and he sat in at that lunch counter. It was a great burden that had been lifted from his shoulders. And I think, you know, that kind of emancipatory liberationist experience probably touched almost everyone who participated in some particular way during the movement. So whether he went on to direct other demonstrations or not is really not important. He went on, he was touched by this, he was involved in this, and then in his own life he's been very, very successful and has continued to be concerned about social justice, but is not involved in the organization. The people who were most involved, who became better known in the civil rights struggle, really came out of Nashville, the Nashville movement that had a sit-in right after Greensboro.
Faith, maybe you can tell us about some of those folks from Nashville. I know since we're in Washington, D.C., we have a little bit more contact with Mary and Barry than most folks, but Diane Nash and those and some other leaders from Nashville.
Well, Nashville, of course, is a bigger city than Greensboro, and has a very distinctive history. And part of that history is Fisk University, which is one of the important historically black colleges and universities, as well as a number of religious oriented seminaries for black denominations that are in Nashville. Meharry, for many years, the primary training site for black doctors in the United States was either Howard University or Meharry. And within Nashville had a distinctive history because some of the people who had actually studied the concept of nonviolence in a with Gandhi in India and with people who were pacifists and anti-nuclear activists and those sorts of people in New York, some of the people who became who had been part of the Fellowship of Reconciliation that joined with others to become the Congress of Racial Equality. A number of these people were in touch with a group of students who were both friends and activist comrades, such as Diane Nash and James Lawson, Marion Barry, and others who were young people in Nashville. They were actively, much more actively, because some of them were philosophy majors and that sort of thing. Some of them were ministers, budding ministers, were thinking really actively about how to create social change in the United States, particularly around race. And therefore, the movement that came out of Nashville was more specifically tied to formal notions of nonviolence than maybe what came out of Greensboro. They were very committed to nonviolence as well, but had less direct training or experience with people who were part of international radical circles than the students who were in Nashville. So Nashville becomes a very formulative. Many of the people who become important in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee come out of Nashville for a lot of complicated reasons. Stephen, I'm sure, wants to elaborate.
But just one other person you should mention, because the students out there might know him today, John Lewis.
Yeah,
John Lewis. From who from Alabama originally, but who went to the American Baptist Seminary in Nashville at that time. And, of course, Lewis is now
a
congressman from Georgia. I just want to emphasize what you said, Faith, about one of those names, because he's not as well known as he should be, and he needs more emphasis, and that's Jim Lawson, who's not a relative of mine, unfortunately. I wish he were, but he's not. Jim Lawson, who is a little older than some of the people
the
like
others.
Diane Nash and John Lewis, he was at Vanderbilt studying for his a divinity degree. But he had, as you said, Faith, he had had a long study of Gandhi and anti-war activity. And he was the one who really created workshops that were held on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, to instill techniques, not just the philosophy of nonviolence, but the techniques of nonviolence. Because
right.
what folks should remember is that, you know, nonviolence is not, you know, natural for most people. And this is true of black people in the South, particularly in the rural South. Most black people, like most white people, are not anti-violence, nonviolence by disposition. It takes an enormous amount of discipline to practice nonviolence and do so in a manner that will be consistent and will be long-lasting. And that's what these workshops, not just talking about Christian nonviolence, but trying to get them into role-playing situations where some of the people would be demonstrators and others would be people who were going to hit them and beat them, and they were taught how to do it. And this was an ongoing process, and there were going to be sit-ins in Nashville. Those were being planned, but Greensboro took place before the Nashville folks could do their first sit-in. But it's that kind of planning, philosophical and tactical plans and tactical discussions that came out of Nashville, which thrust most of the people that Faith mentioned, also Bernard Lafayette, who would become important.
Another person,
Yeah, and SCLC ultimately, and it's not surprising that they did become more of the leadership, because they really had gone through an intensive training for what was to come.
I think it's really crucial to emphasize that nonviolence is not passivity. That
mm-hmm,
I think it
absolutely.
Seems to young people to
mm-hmm.
just be a kind of submission, and that's completely wrong. It is a radical challenging of you know, injustice and evil situation by placing one's own life, one's own body, in the face of this contradiction, but not responding with hate to other people. This is really not the tradition of, let's just say, any religious entity, and not specifically the black church in the United States. The concept of radical nonviolence really comes from India and the international activities of Mohandas Gandhi, who influenced generations of leaders around the world, including people in the United States, including through a process of study and connection, this group of young black people in Nashville who go on to form some of the crucial organizations that help change America. So this sense that people are just sitting there and letting people hurt them does not communicate the tremendous courage and also discipline required to do that. And that's something I think that is a feeling about the civil rights movement that needs to be communicated.
Yeah, I think you can't say that strongly enough. I mean, that's one of the most important things that I try to explain to our students today who think of, you know, nonviolence as somehow weak. And the
right.
Groups like the Black Panthers, you know, they were the, you know, the tough guys.
They
and
were
that's
strong.
Really what it's all about. Yeah. And that's,
no.
I think, you know, part of the problem of faith, I think, is that Gandhi himself, and then the phrase King used it as well, they called it passive resistance.
Right.
And I think that was a mistake. It's not passive at all, as you say. It's active.
It's quite active.
Resistance. It's active resistance. And in fact, this is the kind of discipline and courage it takes, which really is at the essence of manhood. Not the kind of, and anyone could, you know, say they're a man and strike back and fight back, but that doesn't take much. It's what they were able to do in the face of extraordinary danger and to stand up and say, look, you know, I've got what it takes. Let's see you try to do this. I've got what it takes.
Right.
And that is so important, and it's so overlooked today that it's tragic. That's part of the tragic, history of this country, that we've forgotten what these people were really all about. So I agree with you absolutely. If there's no other lesson that we should learn, it should be that one, the courage, the manhood, the activism, and you use the word radical, and that's what I would use as well. That's truly radical in this country. Nonviolent resistance is far more radical than the use of violence. Violence is very
absolutely
ordinary.
Well, that provides us with a perfect question to end on from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the question was, and you already spoke to this, Stephen, that the students in Greensboro didn't really face much in the way of violence in 1960, but what other types of retribution were they faced with?
As a result of the sit-ins?
Yeah.
Part of it would be, although, again, in Greensboro, they had a fairly supportive, you know, black colleges were kind of a mixed bag. On one hand, they were very good because they had, you know, obviously black students learning from black teachers. They emphasized African-American history and culture, and all that was very important. But in many cases, the college presidents who owed their jobs, because these are state universities, who owed their jobs to, white, political leaders in the states had to play a very cautious role. They couldn't speak out publicly in favor of these demonstrations. But at A&T, college president, although he couldn't condone what was going on, they didn't really take any punitive action against the sit-in demonstrators. The professors, in many cases, were supportive. And that was also at Bennett College, which had a remarkable woman as president named Willa Player. And she was just probably more than any other of the college presidents. She was very supportive of the young women. And think about this, young women now who are going to put their bodies on the line. This is 1960, you know. This is not something that college girls are supposed to be doing, going out, putting their themselves.
Risking arrest.
I mean, arrest.
And violence.
You know, think about this. Absolutely. But Willa Player, she counseled these women and so forth. And so they didn't really face, Greensboro was one of these places that, although they had all the kinds of segregation and so forth, it thought of itself as more moderate, and it wanted to uphold, didn't want violence. That was the worst thing that could happen. It would destroy their image. So they did have leadership within the city, within the universities, I think, that were more supportive of what these kids were doing. But that wasn't the case everywhere, and they did risk. If they were arrested and had to serve time in jail, they risked the problems of arrest. Their parents risked problems in some cases because of the activities of their children. that was deeper south, further south, and not in such big cities that you had more of those problems.
Very good. One final question for Bill. Bill, are there plans to exhibit the lunch counter when the museum reopens?
Actually, the lunch counter is presently on exhibition at the National Air and Space Museum as part of an exhibition titled Treasures of American History. The museum is closed for a major architectural renovation and plans to reopen sometime in 2008. During that time, the museum has mounted an exhibition of many very important objects from the scope of American history, which we call treasures. Now, some of them are obvious treasures, such as material from Abraham Lincoln, his top hat, or other things. But we, as historians and curators, consider an object like the lunch counter not only as a symbol and a focal point of this really profound cultural protest, but we consider that a treasure as well.
Very good. We are just about out of time here, and I want to thank Bill Yankst, Faith Davis Ruffins, and Stephen Lawson for their time and insight again today. We've had a lot of good questions and fascinating topics to discuss related to the Woolworth's lunch counter. A reminder for our listeners, we'll be back to answer more questions on this topic next Friday, March 16th, at 10 minutes after 1 Eastern Time, so that we can get in touch with some of those students on the West Coast who are hopefully still asleep at this point, or maybe on their way to their buses. But we will have more opportunities for students and teachers to pose questions for our experts. And a look ahead to next month. The featured object for the month of April is the short-handled hoe owned and used in the fields of the Southwest by members of Cesar Chavez's family. Materials related to the short-handled hoe, the Bracero Guest Worker Program, Cesar Chavez, and the farm worker movement will be available on the website later this afternoon. So any minute now, you can check those out. Thank you for joining us and exploring the object of history with us today.